The information is for educational purposes and not a substitute for medical care. This show is not intended to diagnose, treat, or prescribe. The information described today is not a substitute for your own intuition or consultation with a duly licensed practitioner. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Sam Byrne. I'd like to welcome you to my show, 2020 Eye Talk. We have a really interesting show today. I'm going to be talking about some very interesting topics. But before I get to that, I put on some medicinal essential oils to prepare me for our show today. And there are two that were really speaking to me. One was called tangerine, and this is from the citrus family. And tangerine is one of those medicinal essences that she is really great to help support the children in our life. And since part of this show is going to be about children and kids, I thought that tangerine would be a great support for us. Actually, I've used tangerine to support lots of children who've come to me in the autistic spectrum, and I've also helped adults kind of work through some of their inner child issues. You know, all of us have kind of the part of our childhood where maybe we didn't get exactly what we thought we were getting, and you know, the wounds that that show up for us, we carry with us sometimes, and that affects our, you know, our adult life and how we choose our relationships and things like that. So tangerine is kind of helpful in dissolving some of those inner child boo-boos, those little inner child wounds. The other essence that I use today is one that many of you probably haven't heard of unless you've studied with me. She's actually called white cinnamon bark. And her name in her classic name is Sugandha Kakola. And unlike the cinnamon bark that is more on the yang side, very hot, this particular white cinnamon is very cooling, and I use her quite a bit to help open up the heart area. The white cinnamon bark is actually really good at reducing inflammatory situations. And, you know, whenever we get inflamed, whether it's physical, emotional, spiritual, we get off our center and we start reacting based on that that heat that we're producing. So Sugandha, she is a support for helping us come back into the reminder that we're whole. We're already whole, but it's the reminder that we already are, because sometimes we forget that and we fragment and separate all our different parts, and there you go. We kind of react to many different things instead of, you know, being aware of the possibility of having an open heart and responding to life situations and people from a more whole place. And the more we do that, the more that ripples for others to have the space to do that too. So I'm going to start with a little story that I was involved with. About a month ago, I received a phone call from this place called the Nature Center. And this is a facility, an institution that is up in Los Alamos, which is about a 30-minute drive west of where I live in Tasuki. And they were inquiring about my services but not my eye services, or not directly with my eye services, but they wanted to have a meeting with me. I was very curious about that, so I agreed to come up there, and I met with a couple of folks that run the Nature Center. And what they offered me was the opportunity to do some astronomy sessions with some of their groups. And when I entered their building, this is an amazing place. It's brand new. And there's a wonderful planetarium that they actually have there. I mean, it is one of the best planetariums I've ever seen. You know, state-of-the-art computerization and wonderful, you know, ceiling where you can actually look at so many of the constellations, stars, globular clusters, all those kinds of things. So in my conversations with them, you know, they asked me, well, how did you get interested in astronomy? And I said, well, probably goes back to my days of physics and optics. When I was in high school, I did really well in physics. I loved physics. And when I went to college, I took a few physics courses, although I was a liberal arts major and I took a lot of science courses. And, you know, I was interested in biology, but I also really loved the classics and the arts and creative writing and things like that. But I took enough science to get into the optometry program. And our courses in optometry were physiological optics and geometric optics. So I learned a lot about lenses and prisms as a way to transmit light. And I've talked about lenses, you know, in terms of wearing lenses and how that affects so much more than just the optics of the eye. But I started to get involved in astronomy because obviously you're using optical systems. And about 20 years ago, I bought a telescope that had a very big mirror to it. The bigger the mirror, the deeper into space you can go in terms of capturing the light, because it's all about seeing the light and also seeing the dark, but it's also seeing the light. So I began studying different astronomy people, astronomers, and went to different programs. And now I have star parties at my house a couple times a year where I kind of give a tour of the sky. So how this relates to our show today is that it's all about seeing the big vision. And the tendency that I see with a lot of the patients and students that I work with is that we forget about the big vision. We kind of get very narrow. And I was talking to the Nature Center, and their concern was the people don't even look up anymore. They don't even look into the night sky, especially if they live in a city or there's a lot of light pollution around, or, you know, whatever it is. And certainly the sky, when we look into the sky and we look at some of those deep constellations, we're going to come into a winter, we'll see the Orion Nebulae, which is a forming cluster of stars. It's very, very far away and very large. So relative to our life and what we're involved with, our mind can kind of take over, and, you know, we just kind of fixate on our problems and fixate. When we fixate, our vision tends to kind of follow along, and this is myopia. This is the tunneling of our seeing, and I think it's one of the problems we're having in our culture, that we tunnel so much, we become so focal that we forget about the bigger picture. So I'm going to challenge you, 30-day challenge. For the next 30 days, if you can, at night, go out, walk your dog, or just go outside at night and appreciate the stars and appreciate the sky, the night sky, especially if there's some dark night sky around where you live, because we want to keep the big vision. So my show today is about an interesting topic, and the title of it is called The Gestation, Birth, and Bonding Connection to Our Vision. That's very interesting. I was giving a talk a couple years ago, and that was the title of my talk, and there were a group of optometrists in the audience, and they said, what is gestation, you know, in utero experience of the fetus have to do with the eyes? What does birth have to do with the eyes? I mean, come on. And bonding and attachment, you know, that's, we do that in our first 3 years of life, but what does that have to do with our eyes? Well, when I was at the Gazelle Institute, and I mentioned this in a previous show, the Gazelle Institute was a place, it's not open anymore, it was affiliated with Yale University at one time, and it was started by a physician named Dr. Arnold Gazelle, who was a child development specialist. And, you know, I think it's really interesting when we start studying cycles of development, both in humans and animals and plants, and in this particular case, the cycles of development was something that Gazelle was very interested in. And he, in his curriculum, when I went there in the mid-80s, we studied the effects of what it was like in the gestating chamber for the fetus and how that actually began to affect all our sensory motor systems in our brain. One example would be that, you know, one of the questions we asked mom is, what was your, you know, what was it like when you were in carrying your son or daughter? Were you active? Were you passive? Did you have to have bed rest? You know, there's this whole idea about, you know, if you've had some miscarriages that you need to just rest. And so the fetus doesn't get to experience the movement being in the amniotic fluid. That's actually one of the first places the fetus begins to experience peripheral vision. And movement also stimulates our vestibular system, which is part of the inner ear, which is also very interrelated to our eye movements and very involved with our balance and orientation. So a lot of kids, when I measure their vestibular system, the school-age kids, a lot of times their vestibular system is underacting and their visual system is overacting to help them with their balance and their orientation. It puts a lot of stress on their eyes in order to have to balance. And it goes back to that time in utero when they didn't quite maybe get the movement stimulation that they needed to start activating the vestibular system. So in terms of gestation, there's a lot of you know, influences that we have about our developing vision. And so I'm going to talk a bit about, in this segment, the vestibular connection to vision, and then what happens at birth, our birth experience. You know, the industrial birth revolution or industrial complex has really shifted where we're now kind of birthing babies to the rhythm of the doctor or the hospital. And that isn't always true, but a lot of the birthing process is not natural, and using, you know, different drugs to stimulate the birth experience can actually interfere with some of those sensory motor developmental milestones that we have to go through. And of course, if we've had a C-section, or there have been forceps delivery, or vacuum suction, all of those things begin to affect not only our brain development, our neurological functioning, but our ability to process information and that sensory motor experience that all babies go through in terms of their exploration. And then the third piece of the puzzle, and this is a lot of pre-verbal, is the bonding and attachment. So our bonding, the umbilical cord, when we cut it, when the doctor cuts it, basically the infant has to reacclimate their umbilical connection. And, you know, if it's a premature baby, we have to put the baby in an incubating chamber perhaps. And so that umbilical cord connection can get really confused. And there's also a connection with dad. It's a different kind of a connection, but the fetus and the baby feel things so profoundly, and we have to acknowledge that. And so then the bonding comes into breastfeeding and social engagement and some of the other things that we go into. So we're coming up to a break. We also have a caller on the line. So I'm going to step away for a minute and I'll be back and we'll continue our conversation. This is 2020 iTalk, Dr. Sam Byrne.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding.
Hi, this is Dr. Sam Byrne, 2020 iTalk. I understand we have a caller on the line, Judith.
Yeah.
Are you there? Hi, Judith.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. What can I do for you?
I heard on an NPR program about some scientists that were experimenting with people who had amblyopia and putting them into a dark room for over 7 days, 7 to 10 days. And the fact that the eye is plastic, that the eye will reacclimate and sort of become new again. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, you know, I heard about that. I think they were calling it the dark room experiment to cure lazy eye. And just a little background about that. You know, it's really interesting, you know, that most eye doctors will have the idea that after a certain age you can't improve amblyopia, but it's these kinds of studies that I get so excited about because, as you say, you use the term plastic, and I would say the word plasticity, and there's neuroplasticity, right? And I also use a term called, I would use a term called visual plasticity. And so certainly when you change the stimulus, especially of the lazy eye, because what's happening in the lazy eye is there's a lack of stimulation. And this can actually occur very early at birth. This is kind of goes right along with our show. And in this particular research study, they were really exploring, well, what happens if we put people in a dark room isolation? It certainly wouldn't be my way of working with amblyopia, but I do think that it can create a sense of rest and settle in the nervous system that, and we've done this in our retreats. I've actually done retreats where some of our retreats are in complete darkness, and we'll do that for 24 to 48 hours. And it's very rejuvenative for people. So I think it's exciting to explore these different ways to help stimulate the eyes and vision. I'd like to see more studies done, but you're right on. It's it was an interesting show, and thank you for sharing it. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay, so that was really interesting because, you know, in amblyopia or strabismus means the eyes are crossing either in or out or they're vertically displaced. A lot of times the birth experience actually can create or cause these eye anomalies. And this is why, you know, to be asked the questions, what was going on for you in the gestating period? What was going on for you at birth? And what was the bonding and attachment like? Now, for most adults, they really don't remember these things. But, you know, as we start, you know, doing different processes, and I'm going to introduce one process in a moment, it begins to trigger some of the deeper memories in the brain where we actually do have a certain impulse or maybe impression of that time in our life. And what I have found is those three experiences, gestation, birth, and bonding, are very important imprints in our overall development. If we go back to very early on after conception, at about 18 days old, the human embryo is about 1/8 inch long, but the eyes start growing out of the brain. You can actually see these recognizable bulges, and these are called optical vesicles. And they will invaginate into the brain, and here we go, at about the fourth month, then we start to see the close relationship between the cortex of the brain and the cells of the retina. And I've said this many times, that whenever we work with the eyes, we're working with an extension of the brain. And there's a dialogue that goes on between the developing brain and even the skin of the embryo. So, you know, our skin, our eyes, our brain are very connected to that very early embryological time. And when we start, you know, exploring eyes in kind of a more rehabilitative or therapeutic, where we're dynamically interacting with the eyes, that tissue gets stimulated, and this actually begins to create deeper connections, that neuroplasticity, visual plasticity phenomenon that goes on. But one of the pieces of work that I want to bring in is something called the primitive reflexes, primitive survival reflexes. Now, this is a hot topic, especially in the field of neuropsychology and occupational therapy, even some physical therapy. And it's even started to move its tentacles into behavioral developmental optometry, although in my field, there's a lot of controversy because many of the optometrists want to stay more with the eyeball, and they don't want to really, you know, work with the rest of the body. But here it is. So the primitive reflexes are infant reflexes. These are movement patterns that we all go through, like grasping and clinging and sucking. These are very important movement patterns that actually begin in utero. And they actually start developing even as early as 6 months prenatally. And one of the main mechanisms of these movement patterns is that they begin to stimulate one's ability to adjust to new experiences. So, like, if you're one of those people that goes into Walmart and says, I got to get out of here right away, or you're in a subway station and there's so many people and you're like, I can't handle this, or you're in a really loud, busy airport, you know, any places like that where you have to shift going from, you know, a very quiet environment to a very stimulating environment, probably those reflexes are still influencing your brain and you're not able to adjust to new experiences as easily as maybe you could. So the thing is that, you know, in terms of our visual system does a couple of things. It helps us as our GPS in terms of our steering ability through the world. It helps us with orientation, knowing where we are. It also helps us with localization, seeing details. And it also helps us with understanding gravity and balance. And this is where the primitive reflexes come in. Because one of the earliest reflexes that begins to develop is called the Moro reflex. This is our startle reflex. And we would see it in a young baby, you know, 2 months old. If we picked her up or picked him up, and you would see the head and the arms shaking back and forth. And this reflex is very important in terms of getting us to be able to adjust to, first of all, coming out of the birth canal. That's one of the big adjustments. But then overall, just being able to adjust to light, dark, more stressful experiences, less stressful experiences. And of course, different angles of gravity, our ability to balance, our ability to move. And these are, you know, early kind of brain patterns that we want to really experience that set the stage for us being able to read and write, copy from the board, and things like that. Because what happens is that if our developmental process gets impeded at any time during, you know, that gestation, birth, and bonding, those primitive reflexes don't get to integrate as well as they should. And if they don't integrate, then they tend to dominate our sensory motor responses as we learn and interact around the world, in our world. And what would be some reasons why those reflexes don't integrate? Well, again, it could go back to, you know, having toxicity exposure as a, in the gestation period. It could be, again, lack of movement of mom, you know, being forced to say, I've got to lie in bed because I'm afraid I'm going to have a miscarriage. Or it could be some of the birth experiences that we have that I spoke about, any of them that are, you know, abnormal, like, vacuum suction or forceps delivery or Pitocin drugs or whatever, you know, just any of the unusual birthing experiences. Those are going to affect our primitive reflex integration. And then, of course, in the bonding and attachment and movement, if we don't get to go through our crawling stage, normally a lot of kids that I work with, school age kids, either never crawled or never stayed in the crawling stage long enough, this is going to affect the ability of the primitive reflexes to integrate. So what's the big deal if the reflexes don't integrate? Well, if they don't integrate, they are controlled by a part of the brain called the reptilian brain. And the reptilian brain is the part of our brain where we go into fight, flight, or freeze. So it's a very, like, think of the reptile, it's a very survival-oriented reaction. And a lot of people who develop nearsightedness, myopia, they do so because their eyes are reacting in a fight or flight freeze response. So they're constantly in a hypervigilant state with their vision, which tightens up their eyes and vision. And so they blur it out in the distance and they get nearsighted lenses. And there you go, you're in myopia. But it stems back from, you know, these primitive reflexes not having the time and space to fully integrate. And so if they don't integrate, then there sets up a competition in our brain between the downstairs brain, which is the reptilian brain, and our upstairs brain, which is the cortical brain. And so this is going to limit one's sensory motor developmental process, especially in the visual system. The visual system seems to be really connected to the primitive reflexes. So again, if we look at the Moro reflex, that's the first reflex, that's a survival mechanism, and it's basically composed of a lot of rapid movements of the arms away from the body, and it's a very strong reflex. It's very tied into our fear emotion. In fact, there's a reflex that couples with that called the fear paralysis reflex. And again, the purpose of these reflexes is to help us adjust to coming out of the birth canal. And if the Moro reflex lingers, we begin to see problems in our visual tracking, our balance and vestibular system. It also begins to affect us emotionally, where we develop mood swings, we get fatigued, and it also lowers our immune system, so our boundaries and our ability to have a good immune system, so we're more open to, you know, disease things and stuff like that. So the Moro is one of those reflexes that I check on everybody. And you know what's interesting, that with my work with trauma, a lot of people who've had a traumatic experience, I'm talking about adults now, they actually will show that the Moro reflex emerges. So it's not that these reflexes go away and they never return, but they can resurface if there's been a traumatic event, if you're losing cognitive ability, like your memory, whether it's Alzheimer's or dementia. I find that these reflexes can emerge. So I'm going to talk a little more about the reflexes and how it affects our eyes and vision. We're coming up to another break. This is 2020 Eye Talk, Dr. Sam Byrne.
Feel it all.
Hi, this is Dr. Sam Byrne, 2020 iTalk, and we're talking about some interesting things today in our gestation, birth, and bonding experiences. I have a DVD that I produced. Golly, it's been, you know, it's probably been about 8 years ago, and it's a DVD called ADD to Autism, Reaching Your Child's Potential Naturally. And this DVD has exercises on it that actually help integrate the primitive reflexes. And I was just talking with an autism therapist specialist. She's a world-renowned therapist, and she still uses my DVD. I didn't even know that for her workshops. So that's a good endorsement. I wanted to let you know about some upcoming events that I'm going to be doing. I'm actually offering a retreat in December here in my geodesic dome in Tsukiji. It's called The Byrne Method, Discovering the Hidden Messages Behind Our Eyes. And what we're going to do in that retreat is we're going to explore different imprints that actually affect our visual patterns. And we're going to do a lot of different techniques to help improve our eyes and vision using continuum movement, light therapy, medicinal essences. We're going to use the GDV energy camera so you get to have a reading at the very beginning to see where you're starting. So the dates are December 7th to the 11th, 2015. And if you'd like to register, contact my assistant, Christy, at visionwellness@cybermesa.com or give us a call at 505-469-4949. I'm also doing a retreat at the Esalen Institute. Those of you that live in California, you should really come to this. It's a great event. I've been at Esalen, teaching at Esalen a long time. And the title of this retreat is called The Art of Seeing, Integrating Our Eyes, Brain, and Body for Better Wellness. And it's from March 25th to the 27th, 2016, at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur. Again, you can contact esalen.org or call 1-888-837-2536 to register. I know we're already beginning to fill up because I spoke to the folks at Esalen the other day. So if you've never been to Big Sur, it's a beautiful place, and we'd love to have you. It's a very, very innovative and exciting weekend together. And then I'm going to be on the East Coast in New York City, March 13th to the 15th, 2016. And the title of this workshop is called Eyes All Around, an Inquiry into Perception, Movement, and Awareness. And I'm going to be doing this retreat workshop at my colleague's studio, Mary Abrams. She was an authorized continuum teacher, authorized by Emily Conrad. She's a wonderful somatic body therapist and has graciously invited me to come to New York and to do this three-day event. So we're going to be doing lots of things in the realm of continuum movement and color therapy and medicinal essences. And my friends on the East Coast, I've already invited them, and I think they're going to be coming, so we're going to have a great time. I'm also going to be doing some other events in New York while I'm there, some book signings and lectures and things like that. So if you're in the Northeast and you want to interact with me, just go to my website, www.drsambyrne.com, in the events section. And you can click on that and you can get information on how to register. So I'm talking about the primitive survival reflexes in vision. And again, this particular topic is one that I was introduced to in the early 1990s. My mentor, Dr. Al Sutton, who is not alive anymore, but he was a wonderful man, developmental optometrist, and I spoke about him in other shows. He was keenly interested in the cycles of development, and he actually interacted with Arnold Gazelle. And so he would tell me a lot of stories about Dr. Gazelle and you know, his his research in child development and learning. And one day, Dr. Sutton and I were having a conversation about this particular subject, the primitive reflexes, and he was saying, you know, there's really nobody in the U.S. who's really doing this movement therapy, and I think there's something to it. So he contacted these two optometrists, one from Sweden, one from Denmark, who became dear friends of mine afterwards. Lena Rasmussen and her husband, Thorkild Rasmussen. Thorkild is an optometrist, practices in Denmark, and Lena practices in Stockholm. I've been there a few times visiting them and studying with them. But they had been working with the primitive survival reflexes for many years, and Lena especially had worked with one of the founders of the primitive reflexes in Sweden. And trying to remember her name, and it escapes me right now. But in any way, this occurred in 1975, and so they had done a lot of research with the reflexes. Ah, here's her name, Katarina Johansson Alvegard. So she was the developer of the primitive reflexes in Sweden. And let me just say this, that there are definitely a few different people, tracks of primitive reflex therapy. And it can get a little territorial, you know, where somebody says, well, I own the primitive reflex therapy and, you know, you have to come to study with me. I've studied with all of those folks. They're great people. But I think that there are many ways to work with the primitive reflexes. And I actually really liked the approach that Lena and Thorkild taught, because it was, first of all, very geared towards the eyes and vision, which was my interest. And second of all, they were very open to learn and get feedback as some of their students, like myself, worked with the reflexes. And so I began studying with them in the early 90s, stimulated by Dr. Sutton. We invited them to Florida, and they did a couple of courses. And then we went over to Scandinavia, and we took some more courses. And I became quite expert at working with the reflexes as it affected both children and adults. I also began at that time studying craniosacral therapy. So I was very involved in the fluid body. And I would say that the primitive reflexes tend to stimulate the nervous system, and the craniosacral and then later continuum movement tend to activate the fluid body. And one of the limitations I found about the primitive reflexes is that in just doing the primitive reflex movements, one could stay more stuck in the nervous system reaction of fight, flight, or freeze response. So they weren't able to move out of their traumas as easily, especially if there were some pretty severe traumatic effects. And I observed, especially working with adults, that just doing the movement patterns was not enough. And this is where I began to incorporate some of the fluid awareness, because when we include the fluid body into the primitive reflexes, the fluid body actually begins to develop much earlier than the nervous system. So you're much further upstream, that a lot of times if you start, say, doing some sound and kind of more spiral movement like continuum, along with the primitive reflex knowledge, that actually that softens the survival responses quite a bit, and a person can develop much better self-regulation in terms of dealing with trauma and not going into a full-blown, you know, experience of PTSD, because they are titrating the amount of reflex integration that they're doing by staying in their fluid body. And that may be difficult for some to understand, but just kind of take that in for a minute, because in the general rehab model, and I was in the rehab model too, it gets very conventional, where the main focus about rehab is, well, let's get you functional, let's get you walking, let's get you, you know, picking up a cup and drinking or cutting your food. And I think all those things are really important. But I think that when we go into the fluid body, we come out of the normal time-space awareness, And in doing that, the body says, ah, okay, maybe there's other pathways that I can begin to move in. And that actually begins to heal the trauma. So as you know, I'm kind of an alchemist in that I'm always exploring how to combine different therapies so that we can help people release their self-limiting patterns. And I will say that the primitive reflexes are a very important foundational pattern in the brain that affects how we use our eyes, our ears, and move in our body. So in terms of the reflexes, there are many, many reflexes like the palmar grasp leaf reflex, the plantar reflex, the swimming reflex, the Babkin reflex, the parachute reflex. I mean, there's a lot of them that I've studied, but the ones that most affect the eyes are the Moro reflex, the tonic labyrinth reflex, which is involved with our ability to move our head from side to side and track our eyes, the spinal galant reflex, which is our ticklish reflex, and that's very connected to our ability to wear clothes around our waist. You see a lot of kids that are fidgeting in school still have the spinal galant reflex, and that one starts to get developed when we twist ourselves out of the birth canal. So if we've had a C-section or we didn't come out of the birth canal, but we were kind of pulled out, a lot of times we don't start developing that spinal galant reflex, and that affects us in a negative way. It also, if the spinal galant reflex is still not integrated, that can affect our attention and our focus, and it's part of that ADD, ADHD spectrum of, you know, syndromes that we see a lot of kids have today. The other two reflexes that affect the eyes are the asymmetrical tonic neck reflex, which is related to our ability to visually track horizontally. So in terms of reading and being able to move our eyes across the middle of a page. And then the symmetrical tonic neck reflex, which is related to our ability to move our eyes up and down or out and in, say like copying from the board and things like that. So to put this into a little more of a practical use, I want to share an experience that I had recently with a five-year-old named Terry. And Terry's symptoms included photosensitivity, so really sensitive to bright light, and very sensitive to loud sounds. She had a lot of difficulty in her social situations. That's probably related some to bonding and attachment. And what her way of reacting was, she was in a flight response or a withdrawal response. So, you know, when we're in the primitive reflex reaction, we can fight. Okay, we kind of go in deeper focus, and that can lead to hyperactivity. Or we can go into flight, which means we withdraw, we pull in as a way to kind of take care of ourselves. She also had a lot of motion sickness. She's not able to ride a bike, and she had poor balance. She also had problems with visual fixation. She had excessive blinking. And this sometimes gets into a situation where we actually see tics start to occur. She also avoids eye contact. On a health level, she suffered asthma, eczema, and frequent ear infections. When I tested her muscle tone, she was very, very tight. And she just had a lot of problems in terms of her sensory motor development. So when I tested all of her reflexes were very present, especially the Moro reflex. And so we had her do some integrating work just with the Moro reflex. And her mom called me and said, you know, after doing the Moro reflex for about 3 weeks, she's reading and her blinking is going away. And I'm noticing that she's a little better at establishing eye contact, a little calmer. So it's very, very interesting using the reflexes as a way to soften the reptilian brain domination and moving more into eventually an empathic capability. And that's one of the gifts that I see that integrating the reflexes is that we move out of survival and move into empathy. That's a very interesting shift among many other changes that go on. Okay, we're coming up to our last break, so I'm going to step away for a minute. And when I come back, I'm going to talk a little more about how our eyes affect our development and how our development affects our eyes. I'll be right back. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Sunshine, she's here, you can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. With the air, like I don't care, baby, by the way. Because I'm happy, clap along if you feel like... Hi, this is Dr. Sam Byrne, 2020 Eye Talk, and we're having a nice conversation today about primitive reflexes, development, the eyes, and learning. So it's great to be here. I'm really excited to talk about this subject. In fact, when I was up in Vancouver recently, there was a conversation that next year at our workshop that we're going to explore primitive reflex movement. So that's going to be very interesting. But I'm talking about, you know, how our eyes and our brain work together and how that reptilian brain keeps our eyes from really developing in a way where we can actually, you know, we can actually use our visual system and we're not in an adaptive response of fear or a reaction to the world where we're in a defense strategy. Because with our eyes, because it's our dominant sense in terms of our ability to learn and relate, that if our reptilian brain is really strong, then in fact, it does affect and cloud the way we see things. So I want to talk a little bit about the eyes and eye movements and the vestibular system, which is our ear balance. And you know, if your child has had more than 4 or 5 ear infections, that actually begins to affect those little bones in the ear, those little stones called the vestibular system. And, you know, one of the keys in terms of, you know, being able to learn, and this is for anybody, is that the more we have mastery of our body and our body control, the more we're able to process and absorb what we're learning, what we're doing. A lot of people will come to me and say, you know, I've had a lot of confusion in terms of knowing my right and my left, or up and down, or, you know, I'm not very good at following directions, and I get very addled easily. So it really starts with the mastery of our body, and that actually begins first with the primitive reflexes, but then it also is our relationship to gravity and our ability to connect to our orientation. Because orientation is about knowing where I am, knowing where I've been, and knowing where I'm going. And in dealing with our orientation, the other piece to the puzzle is our ability to deal with our gravity. And so gravity is important in terms of our ability to understand space, time, motion, and eventually our depth perception. That's why it's really important at a young age to do all kinds of different movements and do it at different angles of gravity. You know, one of the things I love about continuum movement is that when we get into a dive in continuum, a lot of times the movements we're doing, first of all, they're very slow, which is very good for the brain to go at a slow speed instead of always going at a fast speed. But also working with different angles to gravity, because the angles to gravity stimulate that vestibular part of us, and it creates a kind of a constant responsiveness in our brain that is necessary for that neuroplasticity, for the neurons to fire to create new neural pathways. And so, you know, this is where even with elders who say, gee, I'm really afraid of losing my balance and things like that, I really find it's good to go into some kind of a process where you're stimulating your orientation mechanism in your visual system and in your vestibular system. And so, I would leave you with this, is that, the better our orientation is and our balance, the more we're able to process information and guide our body through space and make decisions based on our center, that we are in our center. And so these early experiences of gestation, birth, and bonding kind of set the stage for us in terms of what's happening in our sensory motor systems. And that's why in the methods that I promote, even if you're an adult, there are ways that you can clean that up by accessing those different imprints into your experience and into your process. I hope that makes sense. So if you want more information about the primitive reflexes, I wrote a book a few years ago called Without Ritalin, A Natural Approach to ADD. And in that book, I have a chapter on the primitive survival reflexes, and I talk about the reflexes as it relates to the visual system, specifically the visual system. Even though, working with other professionals and therapists, I do feel that the reflex integration program can affect everything from healing trauma to improving digestion to improving sleep to balancing the endocrine system, and on and on and on. So the reflex is a very important work, and also bringing in the fluid body is very helpful because it tends to kind of go hand in hand in terms of really integrating the reflexes in a better way. So we're winding down our show today, and I am heading off to do a retreat, and so I will be off for a few weeks. In some of the shows that we're planning, especially in December, we're going to be moving our time to 5 to 6 p.m. Mountain Time on Thursday. I'm developing a very nice guest list of different professionals and practitioners in the field of spirituality, holistic health, vision science, subtle energies, aromatherapy, body work. And so we're going to start having some conversations with different professionals. So stay tuned for that. I think that's going to be very interesting to have different guests on, and we'll be able to interact and see where we come together. But I am heading off to Hawaii tomorrow, and we are doing our dolphin swim starting on Sunday night. And it's a yearly retreat that we do. My last show, I talked a lot about the dolphins and how I work with them. And our next retreat will be in 2016. Mark the dates, November 6th to the 11th in Kona, Hawaii. So I already have a few people that are wanting to come that couldn't make it this year. We swim with the dolphins every day, and we do a lot of eye therapy and eye work, and connect in with Pele and all the wonderful healing energies of the Big Island. So I do hope you can join us. If you want more information about it, please contact us at www.drsamburn.com. And thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure as always, and we'll see you in November. Have a great day.
Please visit drsamburn.com/events to learn more about his workshops, webinars, and professional trainings. To order Dr. Burn's new book, Taking It In, please contact Vision Wellness at cybermesa.com or call us at 505-469-4949. The Burn Method is a trademark system, and no part of this show can be copied or used without the consent of Dr. Sam Burn.